So I polish off the vibrating circular membrane problem today. I'm going to go into less detail in the end, but I wanted you to see sort of what else happens. I did a special case of solutions that didn't depend on theta the other day. There's plenty of solutions that don't depend on theta, and I found them. They turned out to be related to Bessel functions of order zero. And the zeros of the Bessel function gave you the frequency of the modes of oscillation of those things. So those are the actual pitches you would hear if you whack this drum and listen to it and try to hear a pitch. Those zeros are not exactly commensurate, so that it would sound kind of dissonant. You'd hear a fundamental pitch, which would be the lowest frequency that would give you the pitch of the drum, but it wouldn't be a beautiful musical sound by any means. You get a more beautiful musical sound, they discovered, by sticking on a kettle of air to the drum to sort of cut out some of the frequencies and make it more pronounced pitch. But let's see. So remember what I was doing. The method of separation variables tells you to try U R theta T equals capital R of R, capital theta of theta, times T of T, capital T of T. And when I plugged that into the differential equation, I got a system, or a thing that looked like this. T double prime over T equals R double prime over R. When I write the Laplace operator in polar coordinates, and then I get this 1 over r squared. This is a capital theta double prime over theta.
And I assume my solutions didn't depend on theta, so this part went away, and I got a simpler problem that way.
But now, today, I'm not going to make that assumption. So notice I've got functions of t alone on this side and functions of r and theta over here. The only way a function of t alone could be equal to such a thing was if this thing is equal to a lambda. And now I'm going to continue with the general case and see what happens. So notice the t problem is kind of our standard one. It's t double prime minus lambda t equals zero. And that's going to lead to the frequencies of these oscillations. So the t problem is the last one to do, and it's easy. So the T problem, because there's no other conditions, the T problem is T double prime minus lambda T equals zero, and no other conditions, no boundary conditions, no nothing. But now when I look at the other side, I realize I can pull it further apart. I want to get all the thetas to one side and all the functions of r to one side. So I'll multiply this by r squared. Let's see. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to take this part and mess around with it. I'm going to multiply that red box by r squared. That way it's going to get theta all by itself. Let's see, when I do that, I would get r squared r double prime over r plus r r prime over r. I'll put the minus lambda r squared on this side, and I'll put equals minus theta double prime over theta on the other side. And now when I look at it like this, I realize, aha, here's functions of r on this side and functions of on theta on this side. They all have to be equal to a constant, which I'll call mu. And now I see a problem that's very familiar.
theta double prime over theta equals mu, and
the boundary conditions for this problem are called the periodic boundary conditions. So this is a classic Sturm-Liouville problem, and for my function to hook up properly, the solutions to this problem in theta have to come around and agree when they go around 2 pi. And not only that, I don't want any kinks in my drum. The derivatives would have to agree, so there wouldn't be a kink in the drum. So this has periodic boundary conditions for theta. I haven't gone through this problem, but it's very...
Once you've done a few of these Sturm-Liouville problems, trying to solve this problem so it has periodic solutions.
So it has to have periodic solutions, namely theta at minus pi has to hook up to theta at plus pi. And not only that, but theta prime at minus pi should hook up with theta at pi, prime of pi. And it's not hard to go through the procedure and find out that the only time you get such a thing is when you get Fourier series. And that means, let's see, I've got here the theta problem. Let's see, what is it? I'll put the minus. It's theta double prime plus mu theta equals zero with periodic boundary conditions. The solution to that problem is Fourier series. So that's the theta of the problem. And the solution is that mu has to be equal to n squared. And the theta problem is, let's see, these are capital thetas. And the theta solution are theta sub n of theta is a n cosine n theta plus b n sine theta. So that's going to be a major chunk of the solution. And it's the simple chunk. You don't have to think very hard about it. It's a standard problem. And it's Fourier series. Okay, so that leaves me with the R problem. That's the last thing that's left. And so this R problem is a little different than the previous R problem. Let's see, what is it? It's, here's the R problem. It was R squared R double prime over R, capital R plus R prime over R minus lambda R squared. What was it? Minus lambda R squared equals mu. And the mu has to be n squared. That's the mu. And this leads to something that's called the Bessel problem of order n. Let's see, and we also needed r at one rate, radius 1, to be equal to 0. That's the boundary condition. That's the only boundary condition there is. And so let's see, if I clean this up, it's r squared r double prime plus r prime plus n squared minus lambda, no, let's see, minus lambda r squared times r equals 0, with r of 1 equals 0. That's a singular Sturm-Liouville problem. Lambda, the r equals 0 is a regular singular point, and so you can use the method of Frobenius, and get two solutions exactly like I did. And this is called the Bessel equation of order n.
Should it be minus n squared?
Yeah, it felt like it should be minus n squared. Oh yeah, it should be minus n squared, thank you. So actually the lambda turns out to have to be positive. I mean the negative, because it's going to be minus a minus. So this is actually, I'd like to write this minus lambda r squared minus n squared. Yeah, the lambda turns out to have to be negative, so that makes that look like... This is called the Bessel's equation of order n. After you do a simple change of variables. Order n. After a scaling of the variables. Kind of like what I did before. So remember I scaled it to, I made an S change of variables that kind of cleaned up my equation a little bit. But this is a standard equation that's been studied to death. And the solutions are power series solutions, quite a bit like the ones I got for the Bessel equation of order zero. I won't go through it again because it's a lot to write down. But it's all very similar. And so what you get is the solutions are you'll get an Rn of R. Actually, it's going to be an R. There's going to be two variables. An R, let's call it M of R. It's going to be the Bessel function of order n, called J sub n. And then these are going to be beta sub m of R, where these are the zeros of the nth Bessel function. Where the beta, let's see if I can show you one of those. Where the beta sub m are zeros of Jn of S. Let's see. Lectures. I put that maple demo on the aftermath. There's the demo. This is the Bessel function of order zero. Notice it has a peak at the origin. That made the drum have this great big bulging thing come out in the middle. But the Bessel function of order, let's see which one is that. That's the Bessel function of order two. Notice it starts out zero, kind of like a sine function. So the Bessel functions of order zero are like cosine. The Bessel function of order two is like sine. It starts out at zero, and then it has zeros, and it decays pretty fast. And so these zeros are the parameters that come up in the Bessel function. So here I'm finding the zero of the Bessel function between 4 and 6. It's about 5.13. And so that's what I'm calling R. And then I multiply by it. Let's see, R times R, yeah. In order to make those boundary conditions come in, I have to slide my Bessel function in so this zero happens at 1. And that's where those come up. The work's very similar to what I went through in the zeroth order case. And when you do the problem, you get one solution by power series, and the other solution you can get by reduction of order, and it's a drum ripper, so you chuck it. So that's why it comes up with just the one Bessel function of order n. But the zeros of those things are important. And so you get this gigantic sum of all these orthogonal things. So the fascinating thing is that these are orthogonal. And once again, you'll get a big, hairy, orthogonal sum. So the fact is, Sturm-Liouville theory tells you that these things are orthogonal with respect to a weight function. These RMs are orthogonal on 0, 1 with respect to a weight function. But now the fascinating thing is that the solution to the problem, let's see, n equals 0. Yeah.
My case that I did yesterday is the case of n equals 0 in that problem. So that those cases come up. And those are the ones I solved last time. So n equals 0, I said it was corresponding to theta not being involved, but it corresponds to n being 0 in that problem.
And so the big hairy answer at the very end, it's kind of wild to write down, answer, it's going to be a sum as n goes from 0 to infinity. And then the sum from, as m goes from 1 to infinity, and then we're going to have all these Bessel functions. There's going to be coefficients, O, N, A, N, M, Bessel function of order N, 0 times R, the cosine functions, it's going to be cosine N theta, that's easy. And then we'll have a BNM, Bessel function of order m times mth 0, r, sine n theta. And let's see, this would be it's going to be even more. I'm going to have a cosine beta m t. Cosine beta mt here.
And then I have two more with sine beta mt's there.
So plus, same thing, with sine beta mt's instead of cosine.
Interesting. So these are orthogonal, so that's why you can compute these coefficients by sticking in time equals 0 and just using orthogonality. So it's just like Fourier series. Once you know that basic trick, the coefficients are determined by orthogonality. And the interesting thing, the pitches you hear in the overtones come from the zeros of the various Bessel functions. And they're not exactly beautiful music together. I think a square drum is uglier. The circular drum has a little bit more niceness to its sound, but it's not exactly a beautiful sound. It's more of a boing.
And so the last problem you do is use the initial conditions and the orthogonality of all those functions to figure out the coefficients. To get all the coefficients.
And I don't know, engineers always compute these things and it's in all the books. I think it's good to understand that there's basic modes of oscillation that make up the whole motion. But I don't know if engineers really use this form of the solution very much. There's other ways of doing numerical calculations that if I just wanted to calculate what the thing looks like at a certain time, there might be an easier way of doing it than this hairy method. This clicks out of a valid thing, though. And these Bessel functions converge rapidly. So I could show you in Maple that, you know,
I only need a few turns in the series to get very accurate portrayal of the solution. And what's interesting is when you excite a drum at the various frequencies, then it makes these terms big and the rest would be small because it's like resonance. So you can stick a vibrating thing to the edge of your drum and tune it to the right frequency, and then you suddenly see these nodal sets of the basic modes of oscillation. It's funny how complicated the circular one is, because the square drum, that was actually pretty straightforward and easy. And it was a piece of cake to write out the solution at the end and realize what the coefficients have to be by orthogonality. This is quite a bit more complicated to write out the big gory thing at the end. Anyway, I wanted to make sure I mentioned that to you. I'm not going to do this today, but I want you to know that the next problem on the list in any book on this subject would be, once you polish off the wave equation and the heat equation in a cylinder with circular symmetry, the next problem would be, let's say, the heat equation in a sphere. On a spherical metal ball. Heat equation on a ball. So let's say you got a big metal ball, and then the heat equation would be du dt equals Laplacian of u, and the Laplacian of u, of course, would be in spherical coordinates. So if you have spherical symmetry, you'd get a Laplace operator, and you'd have to express it in spherical coordinates, rho, theta, psi. And so you'd have u of radius, theta, and psi is the one that comes down from the vertical azimuth. And of course you do separation of variables. That's fun to write. And guess what you get in the rho problem? The rho problem is the Legendre equations. So let's see, these are going to be periodic Fourier series. You have periodic boundary conditions for this one and for this one too. Because when you come around your sphere, it's got to hook up. But this one's going to be the Legendre equation. So that the P problem, P of rho problem, there's going to be a bunch of them, they're going to be the Legendre equation. And the solutions to the Legendre equation are even more simple than the solutions to the Bessel equations. They're polynomials, and that's the thing you're studying in the take-home exam. The orthogonal solutions are the Legendre functions. So they're very important things, are the Legendre polynomials. So those are like those Bessel functions of order zero, only even simpler. They turn out to be polynomials. And the Legendre problem equation is a singular, it's one of these ODEs of a singular Stern-Liouville problem of a special type that's been studied to death over the years. Anyway, so that's why I'm getting you exposed to Legendre polynomials in the take-home test. I figured I'd spend some time answering any questions you might have had about the take-home test. I got a couple by email. I thought I'd give a couple hints about them. Is it a hassle for anybody to get to a scanner on a Sunday? Because if it is, I could maybe give you some time.
Hicks is always open. So
okay. Okay. I'm not going to be giving you the absolute deadline of 11:59. I mean, if you need a few extra minutes to get it scanned or something, I don't care. Let's see. So this is a hint for the take-home exam. Number one, if you go back in the notes before I really knew what I was doing with Fourier transforms, I was showing you what they were good for. So that's a relevant thing to go back and look at in the notes. However, if you ask yourself, so the heat problem is for a wire that starts at zero, and the heat equation is du dt equals d2 u dx squared. And we're doing this for x bigger than zero, and starting at time equal to zero. And so at time zero, we want the temperature to look like this. See, it's zero until I get to one, and then it's this little tent-shaped thing, and then it comes back down like this. That's the initial temperature. Or did I call it g of x? What? It's f of x. And so the problem is to solve the heat equation subject to the temperature at time zero is this little tent function and the boundary condition. So that's an initial condition. And the boundary condition is that on the left end it's held refrigerated for all time. And I told you I talked about problems similar to that before we had studied the details about Fourier transform. But you can think about this problem using some of the stuff we did later if you come up with this idea. If you think of, I'm trying to come up with a solution to that problem that's going to always be zero at the origin. And so I could add something on the left here. As long as I thought, aha, if I add it on the left, it's going to keep my temperature zero at the origin. Did anybody have that idea? No. Of what?
Odd extension.
Odd extension, right. So that's the brilliant idea here. So the big hint is, if you think, odd extension to the left, so the odd extension would give me, let's see, here's the real line. I'd have this little tent thing over here. And when I go on this side, the little tent thing would go under. And if you think of it, if this side of the universe is positive temperature and the other side of the universe is balanced but in the negative, you would expect hot stuff come and cold stuff to come and make here and cancel. And so that's what you have to do. So the big idea is solve the problem, let's call this F twiddle. The big idea is solve that for F twiddle. Solve du dt equals d2u dx squared on the whole real line with u of x at time zero to be this new function that you get by odd extension. And then you have to show that, when I get my solution, I have to check that the temperature holds zero at the origin all the time. and it's by symmetry. So you're going to think of odd and even. Odd functions have the property that they better vanish at the origin.
So you'll have to check that u of 0 is equal to 0 for all time. If that happens, then you've solved the original problem. And so another thing you can check is when you take Fourier transform, you can simplify things quite a bit. Also note that, so the Fourier transform at S would be equal to an integral from minus infinity to infinity, f of x, e to the minus 2 pi s x dx. And when you write that in terms of, when you split this into real and imaginary parts, let's see, if f is real, which in temperature business it is, this would be cosine 2 pi sx plus I sine 2 pi sx.
And when you split it into real and imaginary parts and use odd and even, you'll see that certain integrals just go away. And you'll have a simpler integral to deal with. Also note that. And so, for example, if our f here is odd, this cosine thing is an even function. And so you have an odd times an even would be an odd. And so it's this integral with the cosine term that's gonna matter. And the sine one will be... No, wait a minute. This one's going to be 0, right? Odd times even is odd, and we're integrating over a symmetric interval. So this one's actually going to integrate to 0, and you'll only get the sine one. And that's what, if you go back in the notes, you'll see I was talking about the Fourier sine transform back there. And so you can make sense of that, what I was doing back in the beginning there. It's more sophisticated reasoning from what you know now. That's the reason I gave you this problem. So for example, odd times even is odd, and so that would integrate to 0. And so, let's see this one. Integrate from minus n to n, or minus something to something. Minus big number to plus big number equals 0. And this, when you integrate an odd times an odd as an even, you would see that this is equal to 2 times the integral from 0 to infinity of f of x sine 2 pi sx dx. And let's see, where my I would have to come out in front, 2i. That's nice to know. Question?
When you said leave it as an integral, like, or you said you could leave it...
I don't want it to be an integral of an integral, but I...
Oh, okay.
An integral of something.
So f hat we should evaluate?
Yeah, if you can evaluate f hat, you should. There's lots of different ways to do this problem, but if rather than have an integral of an integral, if the integral on the inside is something can compute, you should compute it. I'd like an integral of something. Something rather explicit. Of course, you get partial credit if you do have correct stuff at each step and don't clean it up. It would just be a small number of points for cleaning it up and making it look beautiful. Another one where I wanted to give you a little hint is page 95, the problem about Legendre polynomials. The very last part. It looks like it's asking you to do something pretty hairy and advanced there. But if you go back and review how in Fourier series,
we realized that if we had Thayer's theorem, which is a density fact, Thayer's theorem, which is the density of trigonometric polynomials, plus Bessel's, implies Parseval's. And so if you think about in those terms, when you and Bessel's inequality and identities, so these were not only Bessel's inequalities, but the identities in that Bessel's things. So this was Bessel's and best approximation. Best approximation in L2. Okay, so let's see, remember we showed that the Fourier series, the orthogonal function in the Bessel's, gave me the best approximation in L2 when I used the Fourier coefficients. And then we had Thayer's theorem, which said we could find trigonometric polynomials that were arbitrarily close to the function. And so what that means is, if this is the best approximation and I get trig polynomials that are close, this one's even better. And that's how you show convergence in L2. And you can do the same thing without doing any extra work with Legendre polynomials, but you need something in place of Thayer's theorem. Can you guess what it is? Right. That works. But Thayer's is what allowed us to get arbitrarily close. That told us that we could find trig polynomials that get really close to the function. What are you going to use in the case of Legendre polynomials there?
That you
can
approximate any function by polynomial.
Right.
Yeah, so that's the big hint. For Legendre polynomials, you don't have Thayer's theorem, but you do have... So the aha is we have the Weierstrass theorem. Weierstrass theorem about the density of polynomials. In the context of Legendre polynomials. And the other stuff, the Bessel inequality, that works whenever you have any orthogonal functions. So that's not nearly as much work as you might have thought it was going to be. You don't have to cook up a Dirichlet kernel or anything crazy, wild and crazy like that. Any questions about anything else? I thought I'd do a lot of some review next week, and I thought a good way to do a review that would be meaningful was do it with practice problems. I don't really want to give them to you while you're working on your take-home thing, but maybe I'll just tell you what they are. These are nice problems that kind of belong in the chapter in the book, but Stein is sort of brilliant about putting them, these things, in the problems and giving you just enough hints so that you can do them yourself. It's a pretty good way to learn and understand math. So 14, 15, 16 are incredibly nice problems, and I don't know if you have time to look at them and think about them before class, you get the most out of it. But I was going to do them in class and sort of do it in an interactive way that I hope will be
keep you awake during Dead Week.
Dead Week is kind of a bummer.
And they're great problems. And they're not hard. They're just, you have to think a little bit about Stein's hints, like usual, because it gives you just enough of a hint so that you can do it.
So, any other questions about anything? Yeah.
Can you refresh me on the lingo and the second problem on the take-home exam about, like, compact support?
Oh, compact support. It just means a closed and bounded set, which means, in the context of the real line, the support is contained in a closed interval. So, yeah, so compact support, compact sets in R are exactly the closed and bounded sets. So it means the set where the function is not zero is a closed and bounded set. What? It's not zero. What's contained in it? Yeah, so the support of a function of phi, that's equal to the set of x in the real line where phi of x is not equal to zero. And to be compact support means that the support of phi is contained in a closed interval AB for some AB. And when you're dealing with Fourier functions that you can rescale, you might, and that's why Stein says, you might as well assume AB is 0, 1 half. So because when you rescale something, it's just multiplying the Fourier series by a scaling factor. So it's okay to assume AB equals 0, 1 half in problem 1. And then you want to show, yeah, so if the Fourier transform also has compact support, that means that it would be in some interval. And there he says, well, you think about the interval being from minus n to n. It means that your function is orthogonal to a whole bunch of stuff outside there. And when you think about what that means on the interval in terms of Fourier series, you'll realize the hint that it's going to be a trig. The function has to be a trig polynomial. So the trig polynomial, it's going to be a trig polynomial on the interval from 0 to 1. So your function maybe looks like that. It's a trig polynomial there. But out here it's 0. Because remember, we're assuming it has compact support. So out here and out here, it's a big fat 0. And between 0 and 1, it's a trig polynomial. That's what you got to think about. It's not going to be a terribly hard thing, but it's a neat thing to think about. And he gave you all the hints you need to get going on. By the way, this is an example of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. It's a famous thing. So a point in quantum mechanics, you don't know. A point is given by a probability distribution that the point is inside this little blob. And the more Gaussian that probability density is, the more you're sure that the point
the electron, or whatever you're thinking about, is right there, right? And the thing is, the more concentrated your Gaussian gets, when you take its Fourier transform, the more spread out that one gets. So, and the momentum turns out to be related to the Fourier transform of that probability distribution. So when you're really sure where the point is, you can't be sure about what the momentum is. And when you're sure about the momentum, you can't figure out where the point is. That's the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. And there's a quantitative version of it. But it's exactly a fact about the Fourier transform. If this thing is concentrated in a compact thing, the Fourier transform can't be. And vice versa. So this problem number two is actually a very important thing if you're going to study quantum mechanics, because it is the guts of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. It's a fantastic thing. How many, I know a couple of physics majors in here. How many are there? Oh my gosh, 1, 2, 3. Yeah, so that stuff's good stuff for you guys. Have you been exposed to that in a quantum mechanics class?
Yeah, but they didn't use deformulation. They used matrix.
They used commutators to prove it. Yeah.
They didn't use Fourier transform?
Correct.
Because they didn't assume us.
Yeah. Okay, well, it comes out really nice and beautiful. And if you want, if you're a physics major, you might read ahead in Stein, because he has a nice section on the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. It's kind of right after this stuff. Okay. And if you have any requests for review next week, bring them next week and we'll talk about it. Okay. See you next week.
Oh, I have a question about solution. Can I submit the file in LaTeX form?
You can, yeah, you can, are you using PDF LaTeX?
Yes.
Yeah, just dump it into a PDF file.
Oh.
And then upload the PDF file.
Okay.
You too.